So I treated it like a job. Even though no one was expecting anything from me, I didn't have an agent, I didn't have a publisher, I had just the dream. But you don't realize a dream until you do the work. So I showed up for work as a writer every day.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Anissa Gray, author of the novel Life and Other Love Songs. It's a book that uses music as a metaphor to examine the aftermath of one man's decision on his entire family after they lose the love of their lives.
I think we all have our own sort of private soundtracks for our lives, the ups and the downs, songs that mean something to us, that speak to us. So that's what I was thinking about, how music is such a part of our lives, and in a lot of ways it tells our lives, our life stories, from the beginning to the end, and most of all, love, which is at the heart of this story.
Anissa started her career as a journalist, even though she always knew she wanted to write books. The turning point in her life that brought her back to her passion. Plus, the reason she says writing Life and Other Love Songs was harder than writing her debut novel. And how she processed her own personal tragedies on the page. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. So we're going to jump right in. When did you know that you were a writer?
I would say when I was a pretty little kid, before I could even write words, before I really learned to read, I used to write these stories with picture panels. And it was then that I thought I might become a writer. I wasn't certain I was a writer at that time, but I felt the bug.
So having that feeling as a child, and then actually coming to do so as an adult, what was that trajectory like for you?
Yeah, so I grew up being just a huge reader. And obviously, when I learned to read, writing my own stories. But I went on to college thinking that I would probably be either an English professor or a journalist, with that hope of becoming a writer in the back of my mind. I had student loans and bills to pay, so I needed an actual job. So I ended up becoming a journalist. And I loved it. I still do. That's my day job. But a few years ago, I got pretty burned out in my job. And that whole dream about becoming a writer was revived. And I sat down and I wrote my first novel. It was not very good, but I kept going. So if there are any aspiring writers out there listening, you know, don't stop. Keep going. It's a learning process. And I wrote my second novel, which is the Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls. That novel, I managed to get an agent and a wonderful publisher. And that novel came out in 2019. And that was my first novel.
All right. So you tell that story as if it almost happened nearly overnight. I am a journalist, former television producer, don't do that work anymore. Completely understand what it means to be burned out by the grind of journalism, especially as a Black person in this country and the stories that we have to tend to cover. So in reviving your dream to be a writer besides the day job, you talked about the first novel that you tried to write wasn't very good. But what did that experience teach you about your dreams and what it takes to achieve them?
Well, I mean, I'll go back to my job as a journalist. I mean, it's all I've done for my professional life. And one of the things, if you did the job, you know about deadlines and you know about the need to respect deadlines. So that created a work ethic for me. So when I decided I was going to write a novel, I was quite serious about it. So I treated it like a job. Even though no one was expecting anything from me, I didn't have an agent, I didn't have a publisher. I had just the dream, but you don't realize a dream until you do the work. So I showed up for work as a writer every day, at least for the schedule that I set for myself. And, you know, some days I had good days writing. Some days I had some not great days writing, but I showed up for work every day. And that made the difference. And I think a lot of that discipline comes from having been a writer and respecting and setting those deadlines.
From the first book that was unpublished to the care and feeding of ravenously hungry girls to life and other love songs, how has your writing process changed?
I'm a more comfortable writer now. In the beginning, that's actually a great question because I'm writing now my third novel. So that first novel is an experience in and of itself. It's new. You somewhat have no idea what you're doing. You're trying to figure out the story, but you're also learning craft. So that was sort of learning, and I was just very green with that project. For the second book, that was an entirely different writing process because when I sold my first book, I got a 2-book deal. So I had a deadline for the second book. People were expecting something from me. So there's a lot going on in your head at that time, at least for me with that second novel. I talked to both my agent and my editor, who are wonderful, and they were like, look, the second novel is... It tends to be a challenge to write because you have something out there and now there's some expectation of you. So I was writing against expectations. This novel, the third novel, I feel like a much freer writer. I feel like I know what I'm doing. I told my editor, I feel like a novelist. I couldn't say I felt that way when I wrote my first, but I do so now.
Hmm. Can you talk more about writing against expectation, and I would assume still in the development of your voice as a writer? You say you're more comfortable now, but that's after the mm-hmm. 2 books have come out. So what mm-hmm. has it been like in knowing that, feeling that pressure, like, oh, I got this 2-book deal, I gotta write this book, I gotta make the deadline, I gotta make the money, and there's an audience that's expecting a kind of thing from me?
Yes, it's a lot of pressure. The second novel was really difficult for me to write from that perspective. And then there was also the fact that I was writing during COVID and lockdown. And so there was a lot of newness there. But yeah, for me, and a lot of that is a function of my personality. I tend to put a fair amount of pressure on myself. I tend to speak to myself in a voice that probably literally no one is using in reference to me. But it's the voice that the voices that I think are out there. So just personal pressures that, I take full responsibility for putting on myself.
All right. So then knowing that you were going to have this pressure, even going into the revision of your first novel, can you talk about your publishing process and the deal and, doing the thing that you've always wanted to do after a long career in journalism?
Yeah, for me, it was quite a rare thing. I wrote my first novel in my 40s. It's usually a younger writer's game, but I wrote my first novel in my 40s. And I was really fortunate with respect to the hunt for an agent. I had gone to numerous festivals and I was active in the writing community here. I had a great reading group that actually I still have. And so when I went out to query, I had actually met some agents along the way. So I was I had made sort of a connection, even though I wasn't finished with my novel when I met this agent. But, she was just lovely and wonderful. And I finished my novel and I sent it to her, and I had queried some others as well. And several rejections. But when I sent my novel to her, she was like, this is good, but it has some problems. I need to know that you can fix these problems before we go forward. And I managed to fix the problems and we went forward with Care and Feeding, and it ended up going to auction, which was great. I talked with 3 great, wonderful editors, and I ended up with the editor I have now, Amanda Bergeron at Berkeley. And it's been just a wonderful experience. That whole team has just been incredibly supportive. They believe in the work I do, and it's just been wonderful. The editor-writer relationship is, you really have to get that right, because it's a fairly intimate relationship, because you're writing for me through difficulty. And my editor was right there with me, being able to sort of push back and to be able to challenge me in ways that were really thoughtful and in ways that I could take. Because, you know, you're dealing with someone basically questioning your judgment, you know, questioning your writing. And if that's not done in a way where there's real care and you know that this person is in there with you, that it can make the writing process that much more difficult. And I am incredibly blessed to have an editor who has just the right touch with that.
Can you talk more about what you mean by writing through difficulty, if it's not too personal? Because I would, you know, you're still going through life. Mm-hmm. And so having an editor that is cognizant of the exterior factors, but then also still like, we still got to make this book the best that it can be. And so I'm going to call you out here. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, for my second novel, in addition to having those, you know, writing against expectations that I talked about, there was also COVID. And my father was among the first people to die of COVID. So he died in March of 2020. And, you know, I was writing and I was writing about, and my father and I had a complex relationship. And I was writing about the disappearance of a father. So, you know, there were just a lot of emotions and talking to my editor through that. So she knew all of these things that were going on in my life. And so, you know, we get through that and we get a decent novel and sort of at near the end, when we're in final edits, I had to have a hysterectomy. So I went through sort of a, you know, I'm fine, but it was a scary process, you know, so full hysterectomy during final edits. And, you know, my editor is with me that whole time and still having those difficult conversations and still getting things right, but also having that just incredible emotional support.
So since we're here, let's go to the reading and really talk about the book.
Okay.
Life and Other Love Songs tells the story of Oz Armstead and his family after Oz disappears on his 37th birthday. His wife, already grieving the end of her career, is doubled over by her lost husband, and their daughter is left to fend for herself, while Oz's mother and brother keep going the best way they know how. Told in times before and after the disappearance, Anissa's novel offers a chorus of voices set to the music of Motown to answer the question, can you survive the worst and begin again? Here's Anissa.
So I'm going to read a little bit from the moment where Oz is at a funeral with his wife, and it brings back for him memories of his own family, his mother Pearl, his brother Tommy, and the death of his own father. When Deborah's father died in the summer of 1981, they took his body home to Mississippi. Deborah asked Oz to go with her to the funeral. She had not asked anything important of him since his confession. Over the past year, they had settled into a new normal. It was a routine of trying, which meant self-conscious date nights, fewer arguments, spontaneous emotional outbursts from Deborah. Outbursts that would have Oz sheltering in his basement office, as if her tears were a tornado and he need only wait for the storm to pass. Oz felt like Deborah's request for him to go with her to the funeral was a test. Was he truly sorry? He reminded her that he did not like churches. He reminded her where they'd gotten married, as if he needed to. He reminded her that he had not attended his own father's funeral, not inside the church anyway. She did not press him, but her grief was ambient. It filled every space in their home. When it met with Oz's guilt, he agreed to go. The minute he and Deborah took their seats at the service, he knew he'd made a mistake. He could not get comfortable in the confines of the church pew. Deborah gave him sharp glances every time he moved. His Mahalia Jackson adorned paper fan, identical to the ones fluttering in almost every other hand, proved useless at cutting through the heat that had inched over 80 degrees. He had not been down south since leaving Alabama in 1962 when he was 17. He tried to focus on the service to keep himself from thinking about just how close he suddenly felt to everything he, Pearl, his mother, and Tommy, his brother, thought they'd gotten away from. For them, it had been more than poverty and the humiliations of Jim Crow. For them, it had been life. It had been death. It had been the reason Tommy had said, "Sometimes I wish you'd let me die that night." Oz tried to quiet his thoughts. He focused on the hat on the head of the woman in front of him, trying to name each flower. The hat was black with black daisies and a sizable black mom. What were the other flowers, all done in black? Even as he tried to keep himself grounded with his guessing game, his mind jumped the state line and landed in Alabama on the day of his own father's funeral. On that day, Oz had stood across the street as everyone filed into the church. He'd watched through one of the windows as mourners walked past the casket that had to be closed because of the condition of the body. There was not much of a body left. They all gave their condolences to Pearl. She didn't deserve it, Oz thought. She was to blame for so much, including the fact that Oz could not bring himself to enter that church. He went back across the street to watch and wait in the swelter of that June day. 2 hours later, Pearl emerged from the service dry-eyed and unreadable. Tommy's face was a pained grimace as he struggled to carry the casket with the other pallbearers. His hands were still bandaged from what he and Oz had endured a week before. Oz's forehead and cheek were flecked with painful cuts from shattered glass. Oz caught his brother's eye from across the street. He knew what Tommy was thinking, and he shook his head. He could not join him. It was all he could do to stand there and bear witness. Tommy nodded. He understood. Oz did not stay to watch them load the casket into the hearse. He could not bear that. He knew his father would be carried away and buried soon enough. He was doing his best to put everything at rest. But he was restless now as he sat uncomfortably beside Deborah in the church pew. Everything in him felt unsettled as her voice rose to join the congregation in singing. "Well, look way down the river, and what do you think I see? I see a band of angels, and they're coming after me. Ain't no grave can hold my body down." A chill went through Oz, even as everyone around him fanned hard against the heat. It was the cold realization that, yes, he tried to hide himself behind a Midwestern accent, new ways, and the love of his family. And yes, he tried to bury the truth of who he was along with his father. But he was suddenly seeing a kind of resurrection as he stared in despair at the open casket at the foot of the altar.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So you title the book Life and Other Love Songs, even though so much of it is about heartbreak and death, and yet you equate life or the continuance of life to a love song. Why is that?
Well, first I'll step back and talk a little bit about the title. When I'm writing a book, the title usually comes to me sort of first off, you know, as sort of a North Star to write towards. And that happened with this book. But as we got closer to the end of the writing process, talking to my editor, the title just wasn't working. So we ended up, you know, going back and forth over a bunch of different title ideas, almost to the point of exhaustion. And we got to the end, and my editor sort of came up with this idea, Life and Other Love Songs, and it immediately clicked. And the reason is that one of the main characters, Deborah, in the book is an aspiring singer. She's gifted. She loves music. And music plays a big role because of that in this book. When Oz and Deborah meet, you know, they meet, she's performing, you know, and, you know, they meet and they to a song. And music, particularly the music of Motown, comes up throughout this book. You know, it's soulful. Music for me is, I think we all have our own sort of private soundtracks for our lives, the ups and the downs, songs that mean something to us, that speak to us. And so that's what I was thinking about when that title immediately clicked with me, how music is such a part of our lives. And in a lot of ways, it tells our lives, our life stories from the beginning to the end, and most of all, love, which is at the heart of this story.
Okay, so I'm trying to have grace for Oz because I didn't like him, especially when I found out what he did. I was like, man. Why? But in talking about how he held back his emotions and the scene that you read, which haunted him throughout his life and throughout the pages of the book. Why was it important for you to try to drill down deep into the motives of men in general, but this man specifically? I feel like so many times I see male writers really digging into women, and this was refreshing to see it the other way.
Yeah. Oz was a really difficult character to write. I mean, you have this person who does something absolutely unforgivable, in my opinion. But to carry him through to, I mean, you may not end up liking him in the end. I actually ended up loving Oz. But you do end up understanding him. And that is sort of a writerly goal, to create a character who is, you know, essentially unlikable. But to have, and it's great for me when I hear from readers, you know, how many just hate Oz, but others who just really came to just have a real heart for him. And that's where I ended up after I finished with the character. For me, it was wanting that challenge. And I also wanted to write a really complex character. I was interested in exploring sort of how do you come back from doing the worst? Can you even? So it was really a question. I feel like Oz did come back, but when I sat down to write the character, I wasn't sure that he would.
Mm. And then it almost seems like how do you come back from doing the worst is almost parallel to how do you come back from the dead? Because if you do something so harmful to someone, generally, I would think the immediate reaction, especially if it's your spouse, is that you are dead to them. Like you're so hurt that you can't get over it. Whatever you had before, whatever the relationship was before, that's now completely gone. It's dead. And yet here in this book, he did the worst. He couldn't come back from it initially. And so there was a death in the form of his disappearance. And then we go on this journey to figure out how he justifies what he did, what he's done, what he's doing. I guess, is that what you were playing with? Like, you know, if you do the worst, you could be dead to somebody. So why not just be gone?
I think in a lot of ways, he was dead to Deborah. I mean, when you see how their story wraps up in the end, it's not in a neat bow for them. I don't think it could ever be for her. So in some ways, he was dead to them. But looking at it from Oz's perspective, I felt like it was sort of an opportunity for a resurrection of the self for him. Mm. You had this man sort of in his early life, really trying to find himself, you know, trying to strip away all that he was. He was a boy from Alabama, but he didn't want to keep that accent. You know, he wanted to change in everything. He did not want to be that person. So we stick with him through this period of just really trying to find who he is. He does something horrific and he has to go back and then truly find himself. And through that, you know, we see the resurrection of the man. And I think, in my opinion, a better man, a man who understood and who had compassion and who made an incredible sacrifice to come full circle.
So we've talked about Oz and Deborah, but there is also a third voice in this book, and that is of their daughter, Trinity, who is basically like left to raise herself after a certain point because of all of the grief that her mother is under from losing her dream and not knowing how to cope with that. And then her father going missing and nobody in the family really knowing how to help her through that because everybody's dealing with that grief as well. And so I wonder, where do you see Trinity's story? But because as Oz and Deborah's story doesn't end in a neat bow, Trinity is all over the place, especially as an adult.
See, and I feel like Trinity was kind of finding her place, right? Literally in the last sentences of the book.
Yes.
I felt like I...
But it's like to be continued. We'll see if this growth continues because she's doing a lot.
Yes, she is. But I felt like she had found stability literally in the final words of the book. I closed that manuscript feeling very hopeful for her. Again, not perfect. And I tend not to like wrapping things up for characters in a neat bow. Life doesn't work that way. We hope for our characters. And I ended up having a lot of hope for all of the characters there at the end.
In the midst of this, you talk about it set in the time of Motown, and music plays a big role in the book. And we have Deborah and Oz in Trinity's story. But Oz is a brother who is gay, and it's in the middle of the HIV/AIDS crisis of the 80s that we're seeing not so much his comfortability of being out, but the necessity of doing so to love the person that he did. Why was that an important storyline for you to incorporate in this book about love and love songs?
Because for me, it sort of takes us back to Oz and the relationship between brothers. I have siblings, and that sibling relationship. I wanted to explore a number of familial relationships in this book, you know, mothers and daughters, you know, husbands and wives, you know, partners. And Oz and Tommy, you know, their story as siblings is sort of rooted in trauma. And some of that trauma stems from Tommy having been gay. And, you know, at a time when, you know, even now it's still not perfect for some, but the time when, you know, it just was not spoken about, and the abuse he suffered and all he had to deal with, and Oz as his brother witnessing that. And I was interested in exploring the closeness that developed between them as a result of Tommy being gay. And it wasn't an easy closeness, because Oz, you know, he was not 100% comfortable with it, but he also loved his brother and was also trying to come to a place of understanding, even as Tommy was trying to come to a place of understanding. And so I just wanted that thread to run through the book. And it ran through in Tommy's story. And Tommy is actually one of my favorite characters in the book.
I do like Tommy. What do you want readers to take away from this complex web of family relationships that you've woven?
I think it's a really sort of simple message, you know, even sort of through, we see this family going through some pretty difficult moments. I mean, really stressed, almost to the end of their sort of emotional comfort. But in the end, I think what we see, you know, we talk about where we left Trinity and some of the other characters at the end. In the end, I think the biggest message is that we see the sort of love and care, you know, that through it all, that is what endures for this family, for each member of the family, I would say, even as they have their own struggles.
So now that this book is out and the pressure is kind of off, what are you working on next?
I'm working on a novel, third novel, about it's somewhat broad, still working through things, but it's about family, but more about chosen family, and sort of inside a commune, and what sort of grows out of that, and I'll leave it there.
Chosen family in a commune. Oh boy.
Yeah, I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, there's nothing more to be said until it comes out. All right, so I want to switch to a speed round in a game before I let you go for the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
At the moment, my favorite book is The Good Lord Bird by James McBride. I love that book.
Who is your favorite author?
Probably Jeanette Winterson. She's a British writer.
What is your favorite song?
Oh, man. I'll have to come back to that. That one is...
you wrote a whole book about music.
I know, but I don't have one favorite song or even one favorite genre. You know, it depends on the moment. I mean, right now, I'm listening a lot to Alicia Keys, Authors of Forever. I love that song.
Okay. If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
Well, I think I'd live right here in Atlanta. My wife and I, we love this city. But where would we go? We would go on a couple of African safaris. that's what I want to do most right now.
Yes, I'm here for that. Name three things on your bucket list.
The African safari, finish my third book, and just retire soon from my day job.
Okay, I was like, retire? Like, what you mean, retire? What you talking about?
From my day job.
Okay, I got you. I got you.
Right, full time.
What brings you joy?
Honestly, riding my bike and listening to music. I love that. And being with my family.
What brings you peace?
I would say being with my family.
And if you have one, what is your hidden talent?
I have no hidden talent. I literally have none. You're seeing all I got.
Say it's these words, okay? All right. So our game is called Rewriting the Classics, and classic is however you define it. Name one book you wish you would have written.
Oh, man. Probably Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. That is just, masterful.
Okay. What's one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
I can't think of what. And that is in part because I tend to make peace with any ending of a book, even if I don't like the ending. I try to have peace with it. This is what the author intended. What am I to take away from it?
That's big of you. Because I'm a reader who gets very invested, and then there are books where I've loved the entire book until maybe like the last page, and I'm just like, really?
Bel Canto was that's an ending that, I wouldn't change it. It's what Ampachet intended, but it surprised me. And I was like, okay.
You said Bel Canto?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And so you may or may not answer this question, but name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught, and why.
I can't answer that one.
That's why I said overtaught.
I can't answer that one.
No worries. All right. So my final question for you today, when you're dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the words and work that you've left behind?
That I was a good writer. That's the highest praise right there.
Big thank you to Anissa Gray for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Anissa's latest novel, Life and Other Love Songs, out now from Berkeley. And if you're not following Anissa, check her out on the socials. She's at Anissa Gray Author on Instagram. And Anissa is spelled A-N-I-S-S-A. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's B-L-K and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Anissa about how she grieved the death of her own father by writing the story of Oz. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Minda Honey, author of the memoir, The Heartbreak Years.
I think a lot of Black women, this like ability to invest in ourselves and bet on ourselves happens for us later in life. Like when you think of your favorite Black women celebrities, a lot of them, their career peaks are like when they're 40, whereas a lot of these white women celebrities, their careers peak when they're 20. So like, don't give up on yourself just because you don't have white privilege to like subsidize your dreams.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.